Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Hello there, all you beautiful people. Welcome back to the show. Indie Author Answers number 55, I believe. And this is Jim speaking to you right now that you're listening to. This is Indie Author Answers, but you already knew all that because the British guy at the beginning told you, so I don't know why I'm repeating it. Anyway, here we are. Hope your new year is going well, that you're keeping up with those resolutions, probably to write more or finish that novel or get that short story published or whatever it was. I hope you're doing it. First up, just a little bit of housekeeping. I think I said last week or maybe the week before that if you used the Downcast app to listen to my podcast, you could read along with the entire text, and that actually isn't accurate. I think when I was testing that, I was using an episode that had a shorter amount of text because it does cut it off at some point. So the only real way to ensure that you can read along with the entire text that I read every week is to go to indieauthoranswers.com. Now, that is wonderful if you are listening to this one week at a time. If you're listening to it as it comes out, that'll work just fine. If you are, however, listening to these in the future sometime, that makes it a little bit more difficult. So what I have done to make things a little bit easier is set up some redirect links that will put you to the correct posts. So if you want to start with part one of The Problematic Virtue, go to jimheskett.com/part1. If you want to start with part two, jimheskett.com/part2/part3, and now /part4, and that will get you to the correct blog post that corresponds with the podcast episode. All right, does that make sense? Is that cool? Everybody good? All right, good. Anyway, some news about me. I've just announced the release of Nailgun Messiah, the next book in the Micah Reed series, and the following book, Sallow City, is out to beta readers. I'm hoping to get that feedback back and dash off another draft, get that out to the editor, and then get that proofed. And so hopefully that's going to be out in the wild by April 2016 is my goal. I set out a release schedule for 2016, but I'm trying to actually escalate things and get more of those Micah Reed books out as quickly as possible while still maintaining the highest level of quality, which is a crazy challenge because I'm mad busy with a lot of life stuff and other things going on right now. So it's a challenge. Anyway, that's all I really have to say news-wise. Let's do a tip of the week. And this week I want to talk a bit about the movie Hateful Eight by Quentin Tarantino. Recently I went on a movie binge. I saw the new Star Wars movie, which I reviewed at jimheskett.com, and it was awesome. And then in quick succession, my wife and I saw Joy, the new David O. Russell movie, The Revenant, and Hateful Eight. And I think the week that this podcast will come out, I am also publishing a blog post with reviews of those three movies, The Revenant, Hateful Eight, and Joy. So I'm not going to go into explicit detail. You can go to jimheskett.com and click over to the blog tab to see my movie reviews. But I do just want to give, maybe this is a teaser because this episode should come out 2 days before the blog post. So this will be a teaser of my Hateful Eight review. And I wanted to talk about Hateful Eight specifically because I think there are some really good storytelling lessons in this movie. Mostly what it did wrong. Now, I liked the movie. I've been a big fan of Tarantino's movies ever since I was a wee little one and I saw Pulp Fiction. I think I was, like high school. That's when it came out for me. And, you know, I really liked Reservoir Dogs, and I loved Django Unchained. Django Unchained was a lot of fun at the movies. So Hateful Eight, I liked it. I would put it maybe about in the middle of the pack of Tarantino's movies, it was better than, say, like Kill Bill Volume 2, Death Proof, Inglourious Basterds. Those three movies I didn't really care for. I mean, there were parts of Inglourious Basterds I thought were amazing, like that opening sequence where they're hiding the people under the table. That was so tense. Anyway, back to Hateful Eight. So this movie is long. It's really long. It's like 2 hours and 40 minutes long. And in the Roadshow Theater version, it was over 3 hours because there's an intermission and an overture at the beginning. But so in typical Tarantino style, the movie is mostly dialogue. It's dialogue and people getting shot, basically, is just about all that happens. And Tarantino tries to make his dialogue sequences exciting by having people point guns at each other. And that does work, more or less. This movie, the first 30 minutes or so, is just people traveling in a stagecoach to go to a cabin. And then the last 2 hours of the movie is those people in that one room cabin talking. And that's basically the entire movie. So, sin number one, word economy. I know I've talked about this on the show multiple times before, that if you can use one word instead of two, you always should. And that's something that I think a lot of authors need to learn. And I seem to be kind of the opposite. Like, I know a lot of people, there's that maxim that says, after you write your first draft, you automatically cut 10% out. Because I guess a lot of us tend to run long at the mouth in first draft. I'm exactly the opposite. My first drafts are very short. They're like really long outlines. And then in drafts two and three, I usually go back and add stuff. Like I build character more by adding in dialogue or descriptions and that kind of thing. But as I was watching Hateful Eight, I kept listening to these characters ramble in these long soliloquies and thinking, well, that could be trimmed. That piece of dialogue isn't necessary. I don't know what purpose that serves, or that, you know, the rambling here, that could have been cut in half and would have still gotten the point across. So if you see this movie, pay attention to that kind of thing. Pay attention where the dialogue rambles and it doesn't even need to be there. Sin number two. So another thing that really bothered me about this movie was the way that the characters are introduced. Now, this will be minor spoilery, but it's not going to affect anything. I'm not really spoiling anything in the movie, but the movie begins with a character, with Kurt Russell's character taking a woman to be hanged. He's a bounty hunter. And then while they're on the trail, they meet someone else, and then they meet another person, and they all end up riding in the stagecoach. And the thing is that the way these characters are introduced, the way we learn about them, is either that they go on these long, rambling, exposition-filled soliloquies about who they are and what they've done, or another character does it for them. And that would lead me to my third sin, which I guess I can talk about concurrently, is that there's a huge number of coincidences in this movie. And coincidences, they really plagued my early fiction, and I talked a lot about that in reviewing The Problematic Virtue, that there are a number of coincidences in the book. And one of the storytelling lessons I've tried to get across many times before is it's okay to have a coincidence that gets your characters in trouble. It's not okay to have a coincidence that gets them out of trouble. And the overall, and a reader may buy a coincidence or two throughout your book that's just like two people happen to show up at the same place at the same time, and that's fortuitous and advances the story. You can get away with one or maybe two of those, but besides that, you really need to have them explained, and it's going to stick out to a reader. They're going to be like, well, that doesn't seem, why would these two people just magically appear in the same place at the same time? There's a lot of that in Hateful Eight, where two characters show up. Like when they get to the cabin that they're going to, there's a character there and they're like, hey, isn't that blah, blah, blah? And this bothered me for a couple reasons. One is that it's just a huge, huge coincidence that all these characters show up at the same place at the same time and they all know each other. And also that this movie takes place in the 1870s or 80s. And it's not like in 2016 where people are visible on social media and on television and stuff. This is pre all that. So the fact that they would know who these people are on site, it seemed really strange and it stuck out to me and it bothered me. So, I mean, really, that's all I wanted to complain about the movie. I hope there's some storytelling lessons in there, you know, that the exposition gives you a lot of telling instead of showing. There's coincidences, and there's places where it could be trimmed. Now, I would encourage you to see this movie because it is pretty exciting. There's something that happens about an hour 10 in that changes things and accelerates the plot and makes it pretty exciting. And from there to the end, it's pretty good, and it's a bloody mess. It's a very gory film, very gory. So if you have a sensitive stomach, you might not want to see it. But it might still be worth seeing alone just for these storytelling lessons. And I think that's all I am going to ramble about Hateful Eight. So now we can get back to the business of reading about the problematic virtue. Today we're going to be reading Part 4, Chapter 3, and Part 4, Chapter 4. They are two short chapters, about 800 words apiece. And the first one is an Alex chapter, and the second one is a Brian chapter. And it's important to give a little bit of backstory. If you remember last week, like a week or two had passed, and Brian was at home. He just found out that his ex-girlfriend Heather had overdosed on cocaine and died. So he's moping around the apartment, getting drunk by himself. When Alex comes home, Alex had been out of town for a while. Brian tries to tell Alex about Heather's death, and Alex couldn't give a shit. Couldn't give less of a shit. And so that was a very tense point between them. Alex storms off and goes into his room to do what we don't know. And Brian goes back into his room and begins writing a letter about something, about his role, how he wants to help Alex get him off drugs. And so now the next chapter, part four, chapter three, Alex, we're going to see what Alex has been doing in his room since he stormed off. So here we go. Part three, chapter four. No, wait, that's not right. Reverse that. Part four, chapter three, Alex. Alex sat at his desk, arranging lines of meth on the back of his snowboard with a razor blade. He had snorted two of the first four he laid out, and already his energy levels were rising like water filling a glass. His leg bounced underneath the desk. That irritating, nervous twitch had returned, causing his head to jerk every few seconds. He could sense the blood coursing through his veins. He felt strong, powerful, ready to go out and own the world. He drew the last two lines into one pile and then noticed that the edge of his razor blade had become flecked brown with rust. Alex could not abide a rusty razor blade, and so he reached under his bed and withdrew a guitar case. He set the case, which had not contained a guitar for some time, on his desk and opened it. A pause to marvel at the assortment. His previous collection had been more robust, but his parents had found and destroyed that one a year ago. Building up a fine cache of paraphernalia was more than a hobby, it was an art. He started to remove objects to get his razor blades, which he knew were at the bottom. Four packs of rolling papers. Two metal pipes, one of them an expensive prototype that he almost never used. Three glass pipes. One short standard bowl. One long standard bowl. And one straight puffer pipe. Eight hits of acid on perforated paper in a plastic baggie. Three pinch hitters in a dugout. 10 pipe screens. A small ceramic bong and a two-chambered plastic bong, one chamber for water and one for ice. A quarter pound of weed. One sneak-a-toke, two dozen or so miniature Ziploc baggies, some licked, some still speckled with powder residue. A half dozen film canisters containing various amounts of Xanax, Valium, Percocet, Darvocet, Ecstasy tabs, and mini-thins. Two small glass mirrors. Finally, three unused razor blades. He tossed the old razor blade into his trash can and went to work with a fresh one, enjoying the clean scrapes that the sharpened blade made against the face of his snowboard. Brian's futile plea for sympathy about Heather had Alex wanting just to pack up and move out. He recognized that his initial response to Heather had been harsh, but that woman did not warrant the tiniest little bit of sorrow. Feed the wolf you want to survive, or whatever that dumb Indian saying is. First of all, Alex had never cared about Heather. He had sex with her, mistake number one. The bigger mistake was not recognizing it as the one-night stand it should have been. He had chastised himself for those preventable months of jealousy and pain ever since it happened. He should have said thanks but no thanks and gone off to explore the next conquest. Instead, he got lost in her. In the end, what did it leave me? Nothing. In Alex's estimation, the world would be better off without her. Perhaps her death would bring some good now because she could not instigate any more drama. The mistake had been made, the damage done to his friendship with Brian could all fade away with memories of her. go to her funeral? Just let it be, Brian. Just let it fade away. Nothing good comes from holding on to her as anything more than a mistake from the past. Learn and move on. A shuffling near the door. Alex turned to see a folded sheet of paper work its way underneath. He walked to the door and waited mutely to ensure no knock came next to accompany this silent note. Slowly bending so that his knees would not pop, he retrieved it. Alex read the first sentence or two, realized that whatever Brian had to say would just prolong the whole ordeal, and after crumpling it into a ball, he tossed it into the trash can with the spent razor blade. 4. Brian. Brian, in his dark suit and sunglasses, ran his hands along the glossy wooden pew at the funeral home. He listened to some monotone preacher prattled on about hope and change and peace, but to Brian the speech translated as a bunch of optimistic drivel. He counted 57 others in attendance, a good turnout. Of the 57 people, Brian knew only Heather's mother and father. All the other strangers were nameless caricatures in their nearly identical mourner garb and faces pulled into grimaces. He only thought of the wooden box in the front surrounding the lifeless husk of a girl he used to love. Nothing else mattered. He tried not to imagine her inside. He had not seen her in over 2 years and did not want to break the streak now. Behind the preacher, a slideshow of pictures of Heather played while he spouted his hopeful gibberish. Brian watched the faces of the girl he knew flick by at various ages, at various places, at various stages of her life. High school, family trips, Christmas. Most of the photos did not bother him, but for some reason the slideshow lingered on a picture of a young Heather in a summer dress, in a park, on a blanket holding a dandelion, and Brian lost his composure. The girl in the blanket had been innocent and unsullied. Brian had thought at one point that he could make a life with that girl, but she no longer existed. And she had not existed for a long time before her death, either. After the service, Brian went outside to smoke, but then he slid around the building because he abhorred the idea of shaking hands and making small talk with random people, especially Heather's mother and father. He had never made an effort to know them and had no idea how they must view him. Would they be glad he came, or would they blame him for contributing to their daughter's death? How many times did I get pot or other drugs for Heather? How many other people can I say the same about? Brian whipped out his phone and opened a new text message to Wiles. I'm done. No more meth. No more pot. Do not contact me again. He pressed the send button before he could change his mind, and then he sensed it. The catharsis. The goodbye. The conclusion of a chapter. From now on, he intended no longer to be a negative influence or to contribute to another death. Alex. He had to find another way to help Alex. Brian lit up his first cigarette since this morning. It burned in that same bittersweet and familiar way of a long-anticipated cigarette. He stared at the little tobacco flame in his hand with contempt, angry with himself for identifying with being a smoker, and for being weak enough to submit to cowardly desire. He took out his pack of cigarettes and opened it, 4 left. He crushed the pack in one hand until he was sure all the cigarettes had been mangled. None left. His phone buzzed and he raised it into view, expecting a message from Wiles. Instead, the caller ID showed the number of his prodigal lover. Without thinking, he accepted the call. Hello. Where have you been? I've been around. Her voice on the other end, unhurried and meek. Brian had no desire for banter. He would say what he had to say and be done with it. I called you a couple times, I left you messages, and I told you it was important that you call me back. You haven't been in class either. Yeah, I've been busy, and Brian lost control and the world spilled out of him like rocks in a landslide. Married. Did that slip your mind? Did you just forget to tell me that you've got a husband, or were you playing me the whole time? No, Brian, it's not like that. It's a lot more complicated. I wanted to tell you, I honestly did. I've been messed up inside over this whole thing. This is why it would have been better to leave it alone. I wish I knew how to make you understand. Brian watched the darkly dressed funeral attendees amble out of the front of the funeral home, black suits and dresses contrasting the white marble columns of the building. Subdued pleasantries exchanged, hands shaken, cheeks lightly kissed. You owe me an explanation, he said. I get that you're upset, and I'm sorry about that. I made a mistake. There was just something about you. I don't know what it was. You have to believe me that I didn't want to hurt you. Maybe we can get some coffee and talk about... You don't get it. I don't ever want to see you again. You lied to me and you betrayed your husband. You may be like that, but I'm not. Feel free to continue rationalizing it to yourself whatever way you want. I mean, I own a lot of the blame for this. My own desire is what got me in trouble in the first place. It's all related. Brian, you don't have to... He ended the call. Okay, so there we go. That is two short little chapters in part four of The Problematic Virtue. We are on the inevitable march toward the end of the book. Things are starting to heat up a little bit. And so let's go back and talk about this. We'll start with chapter three, the Alex chapter. And you see chapter three and chapter four here are very, very different chapters. Chapter three here is mostly just Alex getting high in his room. And we have this very long description of Alex's drug paraphernalia. And this is intended to really ram home exactly how deep in the drug world Alex is. And it works. I like this chapter for a lot of reasons. There's a lot that's good about it. There's a couple problems here. But all in all, it works. It does what it's supposed to do, and that's to really remove any doubt that Alex is lost in the drug world. So we start here with Alex alone in his room, sitting at his desk, arranging lines of meth on the snowboard. And he can... So there's a bit of drug description, like his energy level is rising, like water filling a glass. And his legs bouncing, he's got that nervous twitch, blood coursing through his veins, he's strong, he's powerful. So we're getting a sense of why Alex likes doing the meth, aside from, you know, being addicted to it. He feels powerful, strong. So that sort of suggests that Alex, one of Alex's underlying things may be a lack of power, maybe that he feels weak and insecure, and meth makes him feel secure and strong. I don't really know. If that is Alex's underlying problem, it certainly wasn't intentional. I didn't write it with that in mind. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, like I've said before about going back and discovering the theme of your book as you write it. This is the kind of thing that I do to some extent pants my characters. I may like if I were writing this today, this is the kind of thing that might accidentally just spill out naturally as I'm writing, and then as I'm reviewing what I've written, I would look at it and go, okay, this makes sense. This is something that I can go back and layer in as Alex's underlying problem, that he feels weak and he needs to compensate, and then in a subsequent draft, I would make sure that that was more woven into the story. So then we go from the opening description of him doing lines to him needing to get a new razor blade. And that is the excuse to open his guitar case, which is his drug paraphernalia collection. And then we get this really long selection. It's something like 150 words here of just everything that he has in his drug collection. And it's supposed to be overwhelming and sensational. And the list goes on and on because... At some point, you're supposed to be like, Jesus Christ, this guy is just steeped in drug lore. He has everything. He's got, you know, quarter pound of weed. He's got all these different pills. He's got downers, uppers, ecstasy, you know, razor blades, all this stuff. He's got acid. He's got everything in this guitar case, and it's supposed to be overwhelming, and it's supposed to make you really get lost in how lost Alex is. And then we go from there to what's probably the most interesting thing. Actually, wait, no, before I say that, there was something I noticed when I was reading that is a plot hole here that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. When it says, so he paused to marvel at the assortment of drug paraphernalia, and then it says his previous collection had been more robust, but his parents had found and destroyed that one a year ago. Now, this is kind of strange because Alex is, what, 21 years old? He hasn't lived at home, I don't think, for a while. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, if you look exactly at the timeline, yes, maybe a year ago he was living at home. But unless you – that's the kind of thing because – so remember he got in trouble. He moved back home. You probably don't remember because it was a long time ago. It was like 6 months ago when we talked about this. So – after he flunked out of school, he moved back home, and then in the spring semester, so he moved in with his parents, and then he moved back to Boulder. So in terms of the chronology, yes, he was living with his parents 1 year ago. But unless a reader remembered that, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because you're like, wait, he's 21. How did his parents find and destroy his drug collection? So it wouldn't hurt to insert a reminder here that he was living with his parents 1 year before this. Because when it said his parents found and destroyed it, you're like, well, wait, was he in an apartment? Because the only time we saw Alex before this was when, in part two of the book, was when he was living in that fat apartment in downtown Denver and Leroy was over and they were smoking milkshakes. So it's not exactly clear where Alex was when his parents found and destroyed that collection. Was he living with them? Was he at that apartment? So if a reader might gloss over that and not pay any attention, or it might be something that completely takes them out of the story. Okay, anyway, so getting back to the next thing that happens is Alex starts to reflect about Heather. And this is an interesting way to take this chapter, because if you remember in the last chapter, we saw Alex being nothing but completely cold toward Brian. You know, saying, Heather who? I'm not going to go to her funeral, whatever, I don't give a shit. And so now we have Alex reflecting on this, and we get some justification. We get some, at least from Alex's point of view, why he was so cold. And this is interesting, and I kind of like it, that what he is trying to do is he's actually trying to help Brian. He's trying to force Brian to get over Heather, because there had to be something about why Alex was so cold, because in order for Alex's arc, Alex is going to have some kind of redemption at the end of the story, you know, in one way or another, there's got to be some redemption for Alex, because he's the one who's fallen into the dark side of the force after starting out as relatively innocent. You know, he's got to come back some way. So in order to demonstrate that, we have to see Alex's thought process. And I like this. I like it. Works pretty well. Take a drink. If you don't know what that means, go back a couple episodes ago. I explained that. We get a reminder of Alex's history with Heather, that he never cared about her. He had sex with her, and then he dated her for a while, which was also talked about back in part two when Alex and Brian met up with each other again for the first time in a couple years. And so Alex is feeling guilty for dating her, and he knows that he shouldn't. So that's part of the reason why he was cold. And here in this line, perhaps her death would bring some good now because she couldn't instigate any more drama. The mistake that he had made, the damage done to his friendship with Brian, could all just fade away with memories of her. So that second sentence there about the damage done to his friendship with Brian is quite interesting, because this is the first time, I believe, in the book that we have Alex reflecting, at least in this part of the book, you know, within the last 100 pages or so, that Alex is reflecting and shows any kind of interest or value in his relationship with Brian. So this is a little bit of foreshadowing, that even though it would appear that his relationship with Brian is completely beyond repair, they're roommates, but they're not talking to each other, essentially, that Alex still does have at least some little stake in his relationship, his friendship with Brian. And then this chapter ends with a bit of tragic irony, because in the last chapter we had this long description of how Brian was writing this letter, and this letter was going to help Alex, and this letter was going to be the thing that repaired their friendship, and that chapter ended with Brian sliding the letter under the door. So now we know that the first part of this chapter moved back in time a little bit, because Alex sees the note coming under his door, he picks it up, he reads a sentence, and then he throws it away. So that's supposed to be the tragedy, like the thing that could have saved their relationship, Alex isn't interested in reading. Now we move on to part 4, chapter 4, and this is a very different chapter. We have Brian at Heather's funeral. So this is what, like 2 days later after this? And so Brian is just sitting there. There are a lot of adjectives here: monotone preacher, optimistic drivel. So this is very just descriptive. It's very sensory, even though all it really describes is sight. You know, we don't get anything about what Brian feels. He says he ran his hands along the glossy wooden pew, but it doesn't really describe how it feels. There's nothing about it's just what he sees and what he hears. There's none of the other senses are really made use of. But this is the kind of thing that would have been good, would have been a good place to do that, because he's very hypersensitive right now. He's upset. He's watching these people around him, watching this preacher prattle on. He's watching these images of Heather pass across the screen. So we know that Brian is really fucked up right now. He's in a bad place. And using that sensory information would have been a really good way to help us get into his head. So we have Brian reflecting when he sees this picture of Heather at a young age looking innocent about how he thought he could make a life with her. So this is pretty good in showing how devastated Brian is over this. But the problem here is that since it's been like 250 pages of book, 250 paperback pages of book time, you know, like something like 60, 70,000 words, since we saw Brian with Heather, it's not really believable. Maybe if there were more reminders along the way of how Brian and Heather used to be in their good times. I think there's maybe only one or two. There's the part in part three where he goes to buy coffee and the barista reminds him a bit of Heather. But aside from that, he doesn't really reminisce and think about the good times with Heather very much throughout the book. So the emotional weight of her passing isn't as good as it could be if we had seen how affected Brian was by this from before. Make sense? I hope it does. Makes sense in my head, so if it doesn't make sense to you, then I didn't explain it well. But anyway, I'm going to move on because I don't want to talk about it anymore. So then Brian leaves. He goes outside to smoke a cigarette. And he realizes, so now the extra weight impact of Heather's death hits him, that she died, at least he thinks in part, because he used to get drugs for her. So he blames himself, much in the same way that he blamed himself for getting drugs for Alex. You know, we've got this line of inner monologue where he says, how many times did I get pot or other drugs for her? How many people can I say the same about? Then he sends a text message to Wilde that he's done selling meth and don't ever contact him again. So now we have Brian taking some action after his decision a couple chapters ago when he went to sell meth to that Trustafarian in the NCAR parking lot when he was like, I don't want to do this anymore. Now we see Brian actually doing something about it. He's saying, you know, I don't want to. He actually sends a text to Wilde, and now he realizes that he's going to have to shift gears and help Alex somehow. And that because before he hadn't stopped selling meth for Wilde, because Wilde had said he was going to protect Alex. Now, we don't know if Wilde actually did or did not protect Alex, and Brian didn't know that. But now Brian knows, or at least he believes, that Alex will no longer be protected. So he's got to find some other way to help him. We have a bit of his smoker's remorse. And Brian is like in super action mode right now. And this is the first time maybe in the entire book he's been in action mode. He takes the pack of cigarettes, he crushes it, he destroys them. He's like, I'm not going to sell drugs, I'm not going to smoke cigarettes. He's going to be a whole new person. And so it took Heather's death for him to be able to come around to this. And then he gets a call from Megan. And this is just about the worst time he could get a call from her, right? He's devastated, he's just taking action. And so he really lays into Megan. And I know in an earlier draft of this, Megan was much more adversarial. And I think I went back and changed it because I wanted to try to make her seem more sympathetic. So instead of being adversarial with him, she's like, you know, it's complicated. I wanted to tell you. I've been all messed up. I wish I knew how to make you understand. So she basically gives a lot of non-answer answers. And she's like, let's get coffee and talk about it. And he's like, F you. I don't want to see you again. So Brian is really coming into his own here. You know, he's saying, you lied to me, you betrayed your husband, I don't ever want to see you again. So Brian, in one fell swoop, has made three huge changes. He told Wilde he doesn't want to sell drugs, he tells Megan that he's done with her, and the third, which isn't so much huge, but it's meant to be symbolic of the other things, he crushes his cigarettes. So Brian starts taking action, and it may be a little too much. You know, it's kind of like he's just moped along, and something significant happens, and he makes this huge change. And so if you look at character arcs, there's a couple of different ways that you can do it. A character, you know, starts out one way, and then they gradually see things happen, or they actually, you know, do things, and then that gradually changes them. Or another way to do it is a character moves along at one thing, at one pace, and then something really significant happens, something world-changing happens, and that spurs the character to change. So that's more of a sudden arc as opposed to a gradual arc. And so what we're seeing here is while Alex's character arc has basically been gradual and that he's sliding deeper and deeper into the abyss, Brian's character arc is very sudden in that he's been one way, he's been weak, he hasn't stood up for himself, he's let people walk all over him. And now, all of a sudden, because of Heather's death and the aftermath of that, he is not going to take any shit anymore, and he's made a very sudden change into being proactive. You know, with the three character sliders that I talked about way back before, his proactivity has all of a sudden slid all the way to the top. He's not going to take any shit anymore. And whether or not that's believable, I don't really know. Like I was talking before about setting up Heather's death having such a profound effect on him, we can see that it's had a pretty profound effect on him here because he's making all these changes, but I don't know if it's been set up properly. You know, we got a lot of telling about how messed up Brian is over this, but I don't know if it's been set up properly throughout the book to believe that Heather's death could spur Brian to make such significant changes. And anyway, that's all I really have to say about it this week. Thanks for listening, guys. I love you. Now here's the British guy to give you some more information. See you next week.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So come on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.